Okay, today is September 17th, 2008. This is the first interview with Shar Tortorici. Is that how you pronounce
Tortorici.
It? Tortorici, okay. And I apologize, I'm going to butcher that multiple times, I'm sure.
That's okay. Everyone does.
These interview sessions are primarily going to get at governance here on campus, specifically from the aspect of academic staff. But this first interview, we're going to try to get a context to your life and sort of bring us up to your early time here at UW-Madison. So, let's start off. This is a question I ask everyone, regardless of where I've conducted interviews. If you could give me a brief biography of your early years, things like where you grew up, parents,
okay,
school, interests, etc., and then we'll go from there.
Okay. I was born in Madison, but at 3 weeks old, Mom packed us up and moved us out to Seattle because my dad had taken a professorship at UWASH. So then I spent the next 12 years in Seattle as a faculty brat. Spent a lot of time on campus exploring the city. It was a very safe time, so Mom would make sure we had dimes in our penny loafers and knew how to take the bus and told us we could go anywhere. So we were able to explore the city on our own and, just had a ball growing up. A lot of freedom. We were real independent kids and pretty responsible. So, as I said, we could go virtually anywhere. You know, there were some districts that were off limits and we knew what they were and didn't go there, but we could go downtown anytime we wanted by ourselves. And the operative was, if you see a sailor cross the street, and if the sailor tries to talk to you, find an Air Force officer and let him know, because Dad was also Air Force. Mm. So with that in mind, we had our run of the city, and it was wonderful. I went to a school that was built in 1858, first school in the territory, and it's still a functioning school today. It was beautiful, Greek Revival. Loved being a student. I always loved school, so I loved being on campus. And we were the darlings of every fraternity and sorority house there were. And so I have a lot of very happy memories of living in Seattle. Unfortunately, the marriage failed, and my mom decided she wanted to move back to Wisconsin where her family was. So in middle school, we came back here and moved to Middleton, so just a suburb west to Madison. And there too, it was a wonderful place to grow up. It was very small, 6,000 people. Very tightly knit. Everyone knew everyone else. You were everyone's good friend. It was a time when you could have friends of all ages, and you know, it was just much freer than it is now. Again, we had the run of the city, and because we had been very independent in Seattle, Mom was very comfortable letting us either walk or hop the bus to Madison, and we spent a lot of time on this campus as well. We always had theater tickets to the Union Theater. We got season tickets, and my sister and I would always go and watch the plays and just wonder what it would be like to be grown up. So when I graduated from high school, I was lucky enough to be valedictorian, so got a full scholarship, and started out at UW-Milwaukee because I wanted the city experience, but then ended up here at Madison after 1 year to be with the man I loved, my high school sweetheart, who's been my husband for 37 years. And came back here to a very tense campus that was in 1969, and lived through all that. And as a sociology major, and my husband was a political science major, we were in the heat of battle, wanting to end the war, and kind of agog at how some people were responding to the dissonance and how violent it could be. But for the most part, got through it all. We both worked. We got married at 20 and stayed in school. And then I went on to graduate school and became a guidance counselor. I was a guidance counselor for 3 years. And after that, an interesting story, one of the teachers in my district got non-renewed, and she had never looked for a job in her life. She was in her early 40s. She didn't know how. So federal funding had dried up, and so she lost her position. So she and I talked about it, and she was saying, gee, I'd love to work at the university, but I don't know where to even look for a job and blah, blah, blah. And how do I do this? How do I redo my resume? And being a very proud woman, I knew that she wouldn't just let me do it. So I said, you know, my resume's old too. I'm going to update mine. So let's just do it together. And I know where all the jobs are listed at the university, and I'll show you. So when we got to Bascom, where all the jobs were listed, she found a job she wanted, and I said, oh, and I'm qualified for this one, so let's write our cover letters. So we did cover letters together and edited each other's cover letters and sent them in, and we both got the jobs. She lasted 2 years and left, but I lasted 30.
I'm going to start with that and sort of work my way back. So at that point, I mean, you applied for this job. Were you interested in this job?
Or no.
Were you applying?
Okay. No. The only thing that interested me about the job, it was being the testing supervisor of testing and evaluation, and I had been the district coordinator of testing in the district that I worked at as a guidance counselor, and I thought testing was silly. You know, it just didn't give you much of anything. But one of my favorite professors was the director of the office. And Mike Subkowiak was the director at the time, and he was just a delightful professor. And so I thought, well, I'll apply for this job, never thinking I'd even get an interview. But I did. And he was such a doll in the interview. He offered me the job before I walked out, even though he had interviewed a number of other people, and the associate director was not in the interview because I had to come at night since school had already started. I had to come after work, and the associate director was not happy that he had not been in on the choice because he had a favorite from the pool that they don't. So that turned out to be an interesting dilemma throughout our relationship the whole time because sure. I was not his choice. We got along, but it turns out that he had actually been the director of admissions when my dad was getting his PhD here, and my dad had worked for him. So it's a very interesting relationship. But no, I wasn't interested in the job, but I was interested in working for this very wonderful man.
Okay. So how did the, you said school had already started, so did you?
Yes, I broke a contract. As soon as I got offered the job and really thought very hard, should I do this? Because I loved my job as guidance counselor. The district kind of loved me too. I was the first middle school counselor they'd ever had. And I was young, and the other counselor at the high school was elderly and kind of stodgy. And, you know, I just loved it. So I tossed and turned, but I was commuting every day, 25 miles, they were long days and long nights. I also taught several courses in the district, parenting and study skills and things. So I sometimes wouldn't get home till 1 a.m. So, you know, that was a lot. And the thought of being able to ride my bike to campus just seemed wonderful. Plus, being on campus again, you know, there was such a draw. The money wasn't there. I was making more as a guidance counselor for 9 months. But the benefits were fabulous. And so I tossed and turned and then decided I really wanted to take it. So I called up the superintendent and asked if I could meet with him on a Saturday. And the superintendent happened to really like me. I'd helped his daughter. And he was the most gracious man. I also took one of the principals I worked for with me who supported, you know, if your career is going to go this way, should we stand in the way? And so we went to see the superintendent, and they both said, we would be terribly remiss if we didn't let you go. And so they let me go without a fine. You know, there was a fine in the contract for breaking your contract. The same afternoon, that was a Saturday afternoon after school started, the Spanish teacher did the same thing, but she just came with her letter saying she was leaving. I came asking for permission. They let me out. They charged her.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So, good story.
Had they said, we don't want you to leave, I wouldn't have. I would never have left them in the lurch.
Mm-hmm.
but they were both very, very supportive. And in fact, I stayed in touch with them always. I'm still in touch with that principal.
That's great. I didn't have my listening ears on as well as I should have. What school district was this?
That was Poynette.
Poynette. Did you spell that for me?
Poynette.
And so you were living here and commuting there.
Right.
Okay.
Poynette's real tiny. Living there would have been scary. The kids would have been at the house all the time.
I'm going to skip over a couple of these 1960s, 1970s questions that I'm dying to ask about life here on campus and ask you as a then, it sounds like about 12-year-old, so preteen, teenager, what do you recall or do you remember the adjustment from, I mean, Seattle wasn't huge at that time, but it was far bigger than the Middleton-Madison area.
Oh, yeah. Now, the campuses have a very similar feel.
Sure.
So that was one of the reasons we started going, because it was so comfortable for us to go. We just felt like caged animals. You know, the three older kids, the three girls that had experienced the city of Seattle really felt like, oh, gosh, what is there here for us? Nothing. We went to church in Madison because at least it was a larger congregation, and we felt like there were more city aspects to it. But Middleton is a consolidated school district and always was at the time, so there were a lot of farm kids. I'd never been on a farm in my life. I'd driven by some cows, but so we just were kind of agog. The only thing we knew about Wisconsin, we had come to Madison in the summers, and so we knew a little bit about Madison, but we'd seen on the Mickey Mouse Club, there was a Nanette Funicello clip about she moved from California to New Glarus, and we were scared to death that everybody was going to be wearing lederhosen and having these big horn things that made noises, and we thought that's what Madison, Wisconsin would be like, so we were relieved to find that it was an actual city and that there weren't just farms. But there was also some freedom there, because in Seattle, for the most part, we were the kids who had the independence, but other kids had more controls than we did. So a lot of times it would be just my sisters and I doing the exploring, because friends, you know, weren't allowed to go to the Arboretum by themselves. You know, Mom and Dad really did trust us. And in Middleton, everybody could go anywhere. So you could have your pack of friends. That was wonderful. And they were very accepting. Plus, we were way more advanced educationally. So school was real easy. We didn't have to spend much time doing any schoolwork. So we could just kind of explore, and it was nice to explore country. I still occasionally will take that 4-mile walk that I used to take up by the water tower on High Street in Middleton and walk around, and it's still not very developed. Still the same farms, and you know, getting used to that kind of a different life was interesting, but you adjust.
Logistically, how did you and your sisters get from Middleton to Madison? Was there a bus?
There wasn't. You had to walk to Hilldale to get the bus, and that was 3 miles.
Yeah.
But one of my sisters and I would walk the whole 7 down to the Capitol. We were very adventuresome, and we'd cut through Shorewood because we wanted to pretend we had money and could live there. So we always wear our little walking shorts. We always dressed very preppy and little berets, and we'd walk through Shorewood pretending we lived there, and we'd walk downtown and go to the museums. And
Where did you live in Middleton?
By Marshall Park. We lived a block from the lake on Mendota. Mendota
right.
Avenue.
Right.
It's now across from a fabulous park, but it was across from a fabulous marsh at the time, so lots of wildlife.
Okay. Is that where that sort of water splash park they just built? Mendota Mendota Avenue, there's a baseball diamond, and then there's a park there.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, they've right across the street from that park.
Okay, all right.
Directly across the street.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, we drive past there on our shortcut to the airport where we live, so.
Oh, okay. Well, Mom's house was green with brick on the bottom. It was white, right, okay. Red at the time, but it's directly across from the ball diamond, and okay. It's the green one with the red brick.
I'll look for it next time. That's
it's
great.
A split level.
So, you mentioned you were valedictorian. Do you think you're, obviously you had a few years in the Middleton School District before you became valedictorian. Do you think that your time in Seattle had sort of, you said academics?
Oh, it put us so far ahead. Yeah, we were very lucky. My oldest sister was valedictorian as well, and the one in the middle between us was salutatorian. So, and I can't say that we cracked books much. Mm-hmm. Middleton's a great school. In retrospect, they were providing really good education, but we were just accelerated.
And so, did your mother have employment while in Seattle? I ask this because I'm sort of curious as to...
She did. As the marriage was breaking up, Dad switched from working at UW to working for Boeing. And so he was unloading the 707 fleets to emerging countries. So he was gone a lot, which contributed to the, mm-hmm. the failure of the marriage. He would be in Argentina for 3 months or someplace trying to sell off the planes. And so Mom went back to work as a dietitian. She'd gotten a degree here, and she was a very good dietitian. So she applied for a job at Mendota Mental Health as their dietitian and got it. And that's why she moved us here. And her sister lived here and her brother lived in Beloit, so she wanted to be closer to family. Because she had 5 kids by then.
So there were the three old, you said there were three older.
And then two younger. Okay. Yeah. They did not have the benefit of the accelerated education that we did.
So did she work at that facility? It's across the...
The lake,
across
yeah.
Across the lake.
Yeah. Okay. And then she eventually ended up at St. Mary's Hospital as their head dietitian.
So we use the term, people use the term latchkey kids. It sounds like you guys...
Absolutely latchkey kids, although no latchkeys because the house wasn't locked. We never had a key because you didn't need it.
Mm-hmm.
Ever. I don't lock my house now. You could walk in my front door.
Probably not. Shouldn't give anybody your address of your house on here then. I'm just teasing. All right, so you came back here, and this was around the 60s?
62.
So then 62 through 66, 67? Here at Middleton?
I graduated in 68.
Okay. Okay, and then you said you went to Milwaukee.
To Milwaukee for a year, okay. And then came back here in 69.
So let's start there. Why decide to matriculate at Milwaukee?
They gave me a lot of money, and I wanted to be in a bigger city. I thought Madison was really confining. Had I not been in love, I would have stayed in Milwaukee. I loved Milwaukee. It was a real urban campus. Their sociology program obviously was not as good as ours because we're rated number one always. But it's for the research. They were very hands-on. They had a lot of city internships, and it was a wonderful campus to be at. But my husband-to-be was here.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it was pretty quiet on the Milwaukee campus, and it was much more turbulent here. So it was more exciting to be here. So I'd come home on a lot of weekends.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, in Milwaukee, there was, the priests were against mm-hmm. the war, and they were having sit-ins and things. So there were some interesting things there, too.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes Dan would come and stay with me on the weekends, and we'd, watch what was going on. But it very different tenor.
Let's, for the record, get your husband's name on here, since you just mentioned.
Dan.
So did you participate in any of the, while you were in Milwaukee, did you participate in any of the marches?
No, I would come here.
Okay.
you know, we would picket buildings here, but not in Milwaukee. Okay. No, didn't. We watched down to, you know. And in fact, when I first started at Milwaukee, I rented a room as opposed to an apartment. I didn't like it and got an apartment shortly thereafter. But the woman that I rented from was very active in the anti-war movement. So I got to meet all the priests at her house. You know, she would have little rabble-rousing groups. And one time I got home from Madison on a Sunday night at 10 o'clock, and the house was cordoned off, and there were police cars everywhere. So I have no idea. She never told me exactly what they had done. But I wandered back to campus and came back at midnight, and they were gone. So I could go to bed. But then I got an apartment shortly thereafter, thinking, I don't want to be involved in this, really. I got to, you know, be a student first.
Right. So before you came here, it might be sort of tough to parse this out in your mind, but when you would come back here, were there any specific or memorable protests or pickets that you and Dan took part in?
That first year?
Yeah.
Well, I was on campus for the Dow. I skipped high school to come down here. We knew that was going to happen, so we came down just to look.
Let me interrupt, and I hate to do this. Where were you sort of watching during Dow?
Outside the Commerce Building, which
so
is now Ingram.
So yeah. You were right there?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Scared to death?
Yeah, I would bet.
But absolutely agog. Absolutely agog. This is happening in my backyard. How can this be? It was very interesting during those years, because when I came back, I worked, and so I always had a dress code. So I always had a skirt on. I always looked quite nice. So of course, Ralph Hansen and his boys never thought I was involved in anything. They always thought I'd gotten caught up by mistake. And they were so gracious and so polite. And they would say, oh, honey, you really need to go this way because, you know, the guys with the tear gas are coming up here, you know. And I was escorted one time, carried out of a building that was going to be tear gassed because the policeman was so concerned.
Wow.
And, you know, I looked like a secretary, I'm sure. And they thought, oh, just caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. One time the Memorial Union was under a bomb threat, and I had left my book bag in there, and it had my glasses in it, and I had to go to work, and, you know. And they weren't letting anybody in, and I just said, I need my glasses. You know, I really have to have them. So they let me go in and get it. They escorted me in and let me get my book bag with my glasses in them and take it out. And everybody else, they're hollering at, stay away, stay away. But they were always very nice to me. They were not so nice to Dan, but they were always gracious to me.
Is that because Dan was grubby, still a student at that time?
So? Well, we were both still students, but I didn't look like one.
Okay.
I didn't own Bloom Jeans.
Right.
You know, I had to work, so I always looked not like a student. I always looked like a young staff member, I suppose, you know, a young secretary. So I was treated very well. He was not. He looked grubby. He had long hair.
So he sort of, with all due respect, sort of fit into the student protest garb.
And
look.
I didn't. Yeah.
Okay.
And the other thing, when we were, now you asked about coming back from Milwaukee, that was on weekends, and not a whole lot was going on weekends because campus doesn't have classes. And if you're going to disrupt something, it's better to disrupt classes. So when I came back in 69, and the protests were getting hot and heavy in 69 and 70, Dan and I would protest, would picket a building, essentially, with our signs. And then I'd give my sign to Dan. He would walk me to wherever I was going. I never missed a class because I figured I was there to learn. And where he's missing a whole semester and not showing up, he would walk me to the class to make sure I wasn't harassed going in. We knew every odd entrance that we were pretty sure wasn't getting picketed, and I never missed a class. And then he would be right there to pick me up after the class. Very attentive protester. But I never got hassled for going into the building like a lot of people did. Of course, I did respect, you know, a lot of times I was going in through the loading dock or something because it wasn't being picketed. I didn't want to cross a picket line, but I also did not want to miss class. So I did.
What kind of, you said secretarial, what specific jobs were you doing while you were getting your degree here?
I worked in personnel at Westo. Okay. So I was off campus.
Westtown Mall?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was brand new. I worked the switchboard and did personnel stuff.
Neat.
I was the lady who said, the store will be closing in 5 minutes.
Now that part of town had to look different.
Oh yeah.
Back then.
Fields. Memorial was there, and Westtown was there, and then everything else was farm.
And then how did you get from, I mean, those are sort of three spots on a map here, Madison, Westtown, and were you still living at Middleton at that point?
No.
Still
living, No. Left Middleton. On my 18th birthday. So we lived in Madison. Bus, I didn't know how to drive.
Okay.
My mother had, one thing she did restrict me with because she said I was a little wild. I never got my driver's license in high school. She wouldn't sign for me. So I didn't learn to drive until I was 24 and signed a contract to be a guidance counselor.
Wow.
And we didn't own a car. I had 6 weeks to buy a car and learn to drive.
All right, so when you, I'm jumping a little bit here, but all this stuff is very interesting to me, and plus I think it's good to kind of get a timeline. When you came back to Madison after your year at Milwaukee, were you and Dan already married? Did you get married?
Nope. We had apartments on campus, but separate.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we got married junior year.
Okay.
So sophomore year we lived, and actually junior year we lived in separate apartments. And then in the middle of exams junior year we got married. Because I didn't want to be a June bride. So we got married during finals. It was so stupid.
So you got married in December?
May,
okay. So the end of spring.
Yeah.
Semester
you
got married.
Yeah, May 29th, so I wouldn't be a June bride. But it was also right before Memorial Day, and we always thought, well, we'll have a day off the next day, and then they changed Memorial Day, which I think breaks a covenant.
Mm-hmm.
So now we don't have a holiday always after our anniversary.
Right. So did Dan know some of the more prominent student protesters on campus? Or did you know?
Yeah, probably. I mean, did we know Paul Soglin personally? No, but he got enough attention, and we do now. There were an awful lot of people that were in my classes that were standing up at the podium, but I don't know if they were big names. I don't know. You know, the other thing is he worked too. So we only had the school day that we were on campus, and then we were both off campus.
Mm.
So we didn't have the luxury of being able to plot revolution over dinner in the dorms, you know, because we didn't live there.
Right. And it also sounds like from what you said previously that, you know, academics were important.
To me, they were very important. I knew I was going to grad school, and I needed to maintain a scholarship too, because after the marriage failed, Mom struggled.
Sure. So during this time, there was a Dow riot, which you mentioned that you're still in high school for. But then, sort of the other big moment was the Sterling Hall bombing in August.
Ooh.
Were you taking summer school? Were you on campus? What are your memories of that day?
It woke me up. Event? I lived over on Fiedler Lane, which is on the south side. And it woke me up. Now, Dan lived over by the zoo. He was still living at his father's house. And they thought their furnace had exploded. So they all zoomed down the basement and could not understand what that huge, huge noise was. I lived a couple miles further south and heard it. It woke me up. And I'm going, what could that possibly be? You know, and looked out to see if there was a fire, to see if there what was going on, but nothing. So went back to sleep. To find out that Sterling Hall had been bombed and that someone had died was just stunning. I mean, it really did sock you in the stomach and take the wind out of your sails and bring it home. Somebody died, and a dad with children. And then I ended up working in the same building with one of those children. One of the Fasnacht boys worked for the Wisconsin Center for Education Research for a few years. And I actually know, I believe her name's Stephanie, is in the UW Retirement Association now. She's been on campus ever since. You know, it is stunning that someone had to die, because that should not have happened. For as sorry as you feel, these guys tried to do everything possible to make a point. Come on, that's not how you make a point.
So, from your memory, did that change?
Yes.
What was going on campus?
I think the whole climate of campus changed at that point, and people were going, this isn't the way. You know, it's one thing, and it's horrible, and you have to rally around the Kent State police killing people. But for you to kill someone, you know, you don't do that. You don't destroy. Yeah, you can throw a rock through Walgreens or Rennabaum's at the time to make a point. That seemed to be okay with people. But you don't destroy buildings, and you don't destroy people, and you don't destroy people's lives. So I think it did take the wind out of the sails of the movement, and people just didn't have the stomach to do it anymore.
So there was violent protest up to a point, and throwing rocks, at least you're saying throwing rocks was...
But yeah, that was tolerated. But I think people started thinking, gee, not only did the protest end so badly in this, you know, in this situation, but, you know, that guy with the bayonet is in my class. And he got called up, and I really like him, you know. But now he's, what are we doing, you know? He's my age and still has acne, and he's got a bayonet or a rifle, and it, you know, and I'm the bad guy. This doesn't make any sense. So I think people started thinking a little differently. I mean, there were still serious, you know, opposition to the war, but how do you express that opposition? I think people started thinking we got to do it with voting and impeachment and whatever else we have to do. You don't do it with arms. You know, we really weren't talking revolution. How do you have an evolution? So yeah, the campus did change.
Somewhat a shift of gears here, but not, I don't think too much. You mentioned one of your favorite professors that you ended up working for, probably later in the 70s. Were there other favorite professors during your undergrad here?
Oh, I was very lucky. I had wonderful professors. A lot of interesting, and several ended up being my good friends now that I've been on campus. Very provocative. Yeah, there were, I don't think I had a really awful professor. I had, oh yes, I did one. But but for the most part, they were caring and challenging, and I have nothing but accolades for UW-Madison. You know, both undergrad and graduate school. A lot of people say they get lost as undergrads. You can get lost, but you can also go to people's office hours. You can also get to know them a little bit better. We maybe had an advantage in that some of them, probably my favorite person in the whole world has turned out to be a very close friend, Joe Elder in the sociology department, and Joanne was my advisor. And I can't tell you how blessed I feel that they have become family friends and have watched my daughter grow up. And in fact, Joe's sister lives right next door. So she built her retirement house right next door to me. So they're there a lot. Sometimes I'll come home and they'll be in the pool. They have a key to my house, just in case I lock it.
It sounds like your campus experience, undergrad at least, and we'll get into graduate school here in a second, was marked by the protest, but you were sort of working your way through that as you got your degree. I'm wondering, sort of besides the protests, besides the professors, are there other memories, other places on campus that stand out for you as places you either have strong memories to, strong attachments to, or strong feelings towards?
Well, certainly the Union Terrace, because everyone whiled away the hours pretending to be in the south of France on the Union Terrace. The whole Memorial Union experience. I used to go to the main lounge, which is now rehabbed and beautiful, but it was not rehabbed and ugly at the time, but they had a tiny little black and white TV. And at 3 o'clock, Dark Shadows came on. So that gave me just enough time to watch Dark Shadows. There was a group of about 12 of us that would come every day, watch Dark Shadows, and then I had to catch the bus and go to Westtown, because I had to be at Westtown at 5. But I have very fond memories of watching the house at Collins Porch. And going, you know, the cafeteria, going in the morning and getting yogurt and a bagel.
Did you have much need to be at this part of campus, or was there really even at that point, was there at this part? I mean, looking at the buildings, and a lot of them are circa 1970s, late 60s, early 70s buildings.
We had to come here to get our registration at the Stock Pavilion, but that was the only time I was on this end of campus, and this was the farthest reaches you could imagine of campus. You know, you came to the Stock Pavilion to get your card, and the card had to be stamped. You know, you had to physically walk around to register, which was fabulous. It's too bad they're not doing it today, because, you know, when classes would be closed, you'd be in a line and somebody'd say, oh, well, if you can't take that, another student, take this one. And so-and-so is a fabulous professor. You got such good advising in that line. And now it's you and the computer, and nobody's going to tell you what to do. So I actually liked that old registration system. It was very cumbersome, but I really liked it. But no, I was never over here. Van Nuys was as far as I ever took a class. I remember coming as a staff person and giving the placement tests, and it had already been decided before I came that they were going to use Ag Hall. And I went, Ag Hall? Why would you go all the way over to Ag Hall? And then the first time I'm giving placement tests in Ag Hall, the bats are coming and swooping all the kids as they're taking their tests. And I'm going, not doing this again. But I thought it was just so silly because it was so far west. Mm-hmm. Why would you go to Ag Hall? But no, never came over here. The social building, Humanities, was used very frequently, that horrible, ugly building. Mm-hmm. But a lot of classes in Humanities, most of them in social science, a few in commerce, and Van Nuys. You know, that was the rounds that we all made if we were in letters and science in some social science area. Psych, the psychology building, too.
Okay, and which one was the psychology building? Is it still?
It's still, yeah.
But I can't, in my mind, I'm not.
1202 West Johnson, Johnson and Charter.
Oh, okay.
By the
Kitty.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay, thank you. So how soon during your college career did you realize that graduate school was going to be in your future?
Oh, when I was a little girl. That there was just no question. We were raised to think that the only choice, actually we were raised to think that we would come to Wisconsin for school, because mom and dad were both alums. Our grandparents were both alums as well. So we always thought we would come to Wisconsin, and then our choice would come at what graduate school we wanted to go to. So I never thought that I would not go to graduate school.
Was that not only sort of propounded by your family, but also the fact that you mentioned cruising around Seattle, but you also got to see the other UW campus growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Was it being around college too that kind of helped?
Oh, probably, because it's so comfortable. And dad, you know, had summers off, and so we'd pile in the car and we'd go to other campuses where he would give lectures and tour the country. So it is comfortable. It's a comfortable place to be. If you grow up on a campus, you know, I just really feel very lucky that I got to work on it too. You know, I got to just stay in La La Land forever.
Was there any discussion of going to graduate school somewhere else?
Yes. In fact, I applied at Harvard and got in, and they canceled the program. I wanted to go into counseling and guidance, and Harvard had a very good program, but they canceled it and then tried to get me to go into educational psychology instead. But I really wanted the counseling and guidance. I didn't want to be a school psychologist. I wanted to be a school counselor. And so chose here and did not go to Harvard, which kept me out of debt because I would have had to pay a pretty penny. There was no reason to go to Harvard except that it sounded cool, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and I wanted to see if I'd get in.
Were you and Dan, if the program weren't canceled, were you and Dan seriously considering going there?
Yes. Dan said he'd work two jobs if I went to Harvard and had to, you know, pay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, I think, the only place he would have gone, because Cambridge is just so fabulous. And it would be cool to say you had a degree from Harvard, but I don't.
Just a brief aside, the difference between being a school counselor and a school psychologist, just for my own sort of personal and maybe for posterity as well, what's the difference between that, and why did you want to be a counselor and not a psychologist?
Well, oddly enough, I did not want to just be stuck in testing and school psychology, and then ended up in testing. School psychologists at the time, and now still in a lot of districts, are the people who do the assessments and put the labels on the kids. And I wanted to actually have a relationship with the kids and, you know, see them through multiple. A school psychologist frequently will see a student, get the assessment done, and never see the student again. And I really wanted to play a role in students' lives and you know, maybe do some therapeutic interventions. Some school psychologists do, in fact, do that, but it tends to be the counselors or the social workers that are more involved with the family and the student in terms of their, you know, personal development. And I wanted that. I didn't want the other.
Was there, being at the same campus, was there any difference for you, or what were the differences for you being an undergraduate here and a graduate here?
By the time I was a graduate student, it was so calm, so quiet. But in terms of the actual experience in the classroom, the counseling program put you into a block. So suddenly I had a cohort. As an undergrad, you didn't. It didn't. If there were 2,000 sociology graduates, or undergraduates, going to school together, so you really didn't get to know people if you lived off campus. I think where the groups came together were in the dorms or perhaps in the smaller majors. Suddenly I was in a cohort of only 30 people. 500 had applied, only 30 had gotten accepted, so we were pretty cocky that we were a pretty special group. And then those were broken down into 4 cohorts. So you became very close to your colleagues that were going to school, and I am still in touch with 3 of my cohort. We've stayed in touch all these years.
What are the names of the 3 that you've stayed in touch with?
Jim Hansen, Mary Lou, now you're putting me on the line. Jim is on campus though. Jim came back to campus, and we've stayed in touch. Fred Schrank, and what's Mary Lou's last name? She became a professor in Houghton, Michigan. Mary Lou.
It'll come to you at some point.
Yeah, it will. Because I just got a letter from her. I'll go look on my email.
So it sounds like the biggest difference was being able to work in small groups.
The intensity, yeah. the intensity and the emphasis on cooperative learning. That this block is going to progress through this curriculum together, mm-hmm. and you're gonna end up in the field supporting one another. So that was very different than whoever signed up for the class. In undergraduate years, you sometimes ended up in classes because other classes were closed and you just didn't know why you were there, but it fit into your schedule and so you just went. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't necessarily the orientation that I'm gonna get the most I possibly can out of this. In graduate school, you have a very prescripted curriculum, as you know, and there's a reason for it, and it's building block, and it makes more sense because it has been put together for a reason. So graduate school in that regard made a whole lot more sense. I knew why I was there and what I was supposed to be learning in every course.
Was this a two-year master's program?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any teaching responsibilities, or was it a...
No.
Well, this question might be moot, but I'm guessing you have at least an opinion on it. So during your time in graduate school, the teaching assistant organization had strikes at various occasions. Did you have any, I'll use the word relationship with anybody who was a TA
Yes.
during that period?
And I was furious. Teacher strikes are against everything I believe in, and I'm very strong supporter of collective bargaining, but if you strike, you're not hurting anybody but the student. And it just irritated me so much, I actually went to the TAA and said, I will not cross a picket line, but I will go into my building. I will get there. I will get into the building because I'm not going to hurt students. This is a terrible, terrible thing that you're doing. The seniors are not getting the recommendations they need to get into graduate school. Anybody in math, in any building block class, you are hampering from getting that background that they need to be successful in the next class. It's just not fair. And when I was a guidance counselor, those were the years of Hortonville and where teachers actually went out on strike, and MTI in 1977 went out on strike, and I thought it was just awful. Yes, I drove to Hortonville with food in the car to support the teachers. Yes, I did on occasion join the picket line at night with MTI because they were my friends, but I thought teacher striking was the worst thing they could ever possibly do. So I did not have a great deal of sympathy for them. And in this last go round, when they, 4 years ago maybe? Maybe not even that long ago, but when the TAA was so angry because they were going to get charged for health insurance and they were picketing buildings, they were picketing buildings on campus. They were negotiating with the State Office of Employment Relations. Now, why are you picketing here when you're negotiating with the state office? That's who is doing your contract. And when I stopped the picketers that were picketing my building and said, excuse me, why don't you go downtown and picket Osher? They said, what are you talking about? They said, well, why are you picketing the university? Because that's where we work. Well, that's not who signs your contract. They did not know. They did not know. They'd never heard of the Office of State Employment Relations. Okay, that's who your labor negotiators, you know, I was stunned. I was absolutely stunned. But I very conservative in terms of who should go out on strike.
So a master's degree prepared you then for employment in the counseling, educational counseling field, is that correct?
Yes, as a practitioner, yeah. Okay. Yeah, the people who went on and got PhDs tended to go into the faculty ranks. or high-level administration. When I came back here, I started my doctoral work in educational psychology. But then when Angie came along, I stopped. So I'd never finished my PhD. But I would have. But I really wanted to be a practitioner.
So we already know from your initial, brief biography where you ended up. Were there other choices when after you got the degree and you were starting to look for gainful employment?
I'd already been offered a job before I finished my degree.
There probably would have been, but there
yeah,
wasn't
I was
reason.
Offered a job in Madison, and I didn't want to take it. I wanted the flexibility of a smaller district because I wanted to do whatever I wanted to do. You know, I didn't want somebody scripting my job from downtown, which is... So I got a job offer in Madison. I got a job offer in Eau Claire. And I got a job offer in Poinette. Plus, there was an administrator in Poinette who was just terrific. And Bill Consemius, who ended up being the superintendent, I believe, at Verona. But he was just terrific, and working with him made it so desirable. He had this great reputation. And when I got that job offer, I said, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure I could have gotten a job. Most naive and silly.
So did you choose Poynton because of its
Poinette,
excuse me, because of its proximity?
Yep. And this one school psychologist administrator who was terrific.
Did you feel once you got sort of boots on the ground and started working, did you feel that your education in Madison did indeed prepare you for...
Absolutely. Absolutely. I felt really, really capable of doing what needed to be done. And in fact, they had never had a middle school, elementary school counselor before, so they were so open. The district had been an IGE district, the individually guided instruction that the Sears Foundation had supported. So they were open to any innovation, and they loved group work, and the administration was supportive, the school board was supportive, the kids were thrilled to have different perspectives. The staff was accepting. I couldn't ask for a better place to be. And I got into working with puppets, and it was wonderful. We could do all sorts of in the social studies classes on values and career decision making, and I truly was welcomed with open arms to work with the staff and with groups however I wanted to work with them. And so it was a perfect choice.
You mentioned earlier that those were long days. You obviously stayed back here, lived here in Madison. And was that putting any stress on personal stuff?
Oh yeah, the year that after school had started and that I broke my contract, the first day of school, my husband kissed me and said, I'll see you in June. So yeah, it took its toll. Plus I was the union rep. So whenever you had union meetings, they were in Portage and they would go to the wee hours of the morning. Parent-teacher conferences, anytime you had conferences, they'd be very late into the night. So yeah, it was very, I didn't see Dan for those years.
You mentioned you were a union rep, and I think this might be sort of a nice segue, sort of end here to start next time. When did you become, was that something you immediately became involved in when you got the job?
Yes. As an intern in Stoughton and then in Poinette, the union in WEAC was very strong in this area. And everyone was expected. Yeah, I believe they all had fair share, so you were paying the union dues anyway, so why not get involved and try and shape what's going on? In Poinette, they had both WEAC and Wisconsin Federation of Teachers, so WEAC was not as strong, but it was stronger, and they were trying to pull things together because WFT was pulling some icky things because they wanted control of that contract. But your bread and butter depended on how those contracts were negotiated. So, yes, I wanted to be very active.
So I think sort of maybe one more question from me, and then if you have anything to add, and we'll end it here. Because I think this does segue nicely. So you work with your friend to help her get prepared for a job here. You end up getting a job here. In terms of being involved in governance and issues like that, is that something you wanted to do as soon as you got here? When did that start to...
I looked for the WEAC. I assumed that WEAC had a presence on the Madison campus. I was stunned to find out they didn't. You know, it even back then was the strongest Wisconsin lobby. And so looking around and went and talked to my dear advisor, Joanne Elder, who had already started the Madison Academic Staff Association in lieu of having a union presence because there wasn't collective bargaining. Now, on the Madison campus at that time, there was United Faculty. I'm not sure it was called United Faculty at the time. United Faculty and Academic Staff. It could have been called something else. And then there was another little startup that was not affiliated. But WEAC had no presence at all on the Madison campus. And because of my experience with WFT, I was not gravitating towards the UFAS folks. But I went to Joanne and said, you know, where's WEAC? And she said, well, we don't have collective bargaining, so we don't have a union, strong union presence here, but I have this association. Started work on Tuesday, talked to Joanne on Thursday. There was a meeting after work on Thursday, and I've been on the steering committee of MASA ever since, and still am in retirement.
I think for a couple reasons, which I won't put on the tape here, that's a good point for me to stop asking questions now. But I always try to leave our narrator with the last word. Is there anything that's on your mind that you would like to get on the recording? Anything you may have said during the last hour or so that you want to elaborate on? Okay. All right, so this will end our first session. And as I said, okay. Once we get done here, we'll sign the release form and set up our next session. So thank you very much for coming.
Yes.